Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's not every day that we get a Hall of Famer in the building, but my next guest is just that. Inducted to the Baseball Hall of Fame earlier this year, Tim Raines started his career as a second baseman in the Montreal Expos farm system, but quickly moved to the outfield, where he excelled as not just a great defender, but one of the best offensive players in baseball history. In 1981, Raines was cited by Sporting News as one of the players that changed baseball forever. His ability to get on base and then steal subsequent bases led to a surge in players with that skill. Raines had a tremendous career in Montreal, and he came here to Chicago in the early 90s to be part of the White Sox 1993 playoff run in the shortened 94 season, and he made his way back to Chicago as the first base coach for the World Series champs in 2005. Tim Raines has written a memoir about his life on the base paths. It's called Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. In the book, he talks baseball, but also some off-the-field issues like drug addiction and lupus, the disease that ultimately forced him to retire. As a baseball fan of a certain age, it is my pleasure to welcome Tim Rock Raines to the big table tonight. Mr. Raines, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to it. The first chapter, you get right into your drug addiction. I mean, is that on purpose to set the table for your career, to get that issue out of the way, the cocaine use in the early 80s?
Pretty much, but that's how my career kind of started. I mean, actually, you know, I got off to a great start my rookie season. You know, I stole 50 bases in the first 55 games. We go on strike. I ended up with like 71 in 88 games, and you know, that's how it all got going. But shortly after that, you know, I got into the issues with drugs. And I still to this day wonder how in the heck I had such a good year that year. And kind of got through that with the help of, you know, realizing I had a problem, one. And the help of some great players, Andre Dawson, Gary Carter, and the rest of the crew that I was with, you know, Ellis Valentine and Warren Cromartie, Steve Rogers, guys like that, man, just kind of pulled together and kind of brought me on and made me realize, you know, that I'm a good player, so let's go out and play. You know, forget about all that other stuff. Let's go play some baseball. And that was all it took.
And it was surprising to me. I opened up the book a couple of days ago, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to start. I'm sure we'll start with Small Town Story, but you got right into it as the first chapter. You know, when you talk about Andre Dawson, you talk about some of the other players in the Expos, you really do talk about how those players helped you as you were dealing with this addiction and the rehab afterwards. And you also talk in the book about falling in with a wrong crowd, players that didn't care necessarily, that you know, helped with your partying ways. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about playing at the professional level and you talk about the groups and the players that you hang out with, how important is it? How important is it to find yourself with the right crew?
It's important, but I think when you're young, you don't really understand that part of the game yet, you know. And another thing, back in those days, the veteran guys kind of treated the rookies like you got to earn your way to be one of us,
right,
you
right.
know. I mean, we had to polish shoes and carry big stereos around, you know, on the plane and off the plane. I mean, we had to do a lot of stuff. I mean, we could only speak when we were spoken to. Unfortunately, and thank God, you know, that I was an everyday player when I first got up there, that guys kind of took care of me and I didn't have to do a lot of that, a lot of that stuff. But, you know, back in the day, that was really, really a situation with veterans and younger players. So even though I didn't have to go through that, but, you know, I kind of hung out with some guys, you know, that were older and that had time in the major leagues. And, you know, at that time, unless, you know, you don't know who to hang out with, you know, here I am a small town guy. I'm from a really small town in Florida, and I go to Montreal. I don't speak the language. It's hard to, you know, get along with anyone there other than your teammates. Right. And, you know, if you don't know many teammates, it's kind of hard to fit in other than on the field. So it was just a situation. It was a partying town. I mean, one of the most partying towns in all of Major League Baseball. I mean, if you can ask anyone that ever came to Montreal, had never been there before or realized how, you know, things are in Montreal, it's very easy. I mean, you know, there were guys, I'm not going to mention any name, but there were guys that, you know, when they came to Montreal, they didn't go to the hotel first. They would go to some club,
a
bar or something. So that was how it was. I mean, fortunately or unfortunately for me, you know, that's how it got started.
Yeah.
You know, when and I never was like that in the minor leagues. I was never like that in high school. I've always been that kind of guy that, you know, came to work, did my job, and tried to be the best that I could be. But all of a sudden, I've gotten to the major leagues, and, you know, you're 21, 20 years old. I mean, I didn't go to college. But it's like being in college without being in college.
And not to mention, I mean, you had such a great rookie year. You were famous. I mean, you were a celebrity in Montreal, mm-hmm. in the way that at that time the Expos fans were rabid for the team, and you were the young star on the team. So there's a lot that goes into celebrity and culture.
Right, and that happened overnight. You know, my first couple of call-ups, you know, I pinch ran. I mean, I was successful running. But when the first opportunity I got, you know, to swing the bat didn't go so well. You know, I was 1-for-20. I batted like 50 in my first, like,
that's hard to believe. Yeah.
Right, at trying to be an all-around player. But, you know, my first full year, things turned around, not only for me, for the team as well. And I was a big part of the success for that team.
I think about that, and I kind of reference the sporting news talking about you and other players, young players, rookies coming in that were changing the game of baseball. And there's really an emphasis on the way that you played, the way that it almost was the beginning of what we kind of know as a five-tool player, mm-hmm. this idea that you could steal bases, you could hit for a switch hitter, you could had an on-base percentage that was through the roof, you're a defensive player. I mean, you really were a prototype of players that really the league hadn't seen yet. Did you think about it that way as a rookie when you were coming up, that you could do things that other players couldn't?
Not necessarily, because, you know, at the major league level, I hadn't done anything yet. So I kind of had to prove not only to the organization, the team, Major League Baseball, that, and myself, that, you know, I could play at the major league level. I remember my last year in the minor leagues. I was minor league player of the year. I did everything I needed to do in the minor leagues. There was nothing else for me to do at the minor league level. But, you know, the next step was trying to do that kind of stuff at the major league level.
Yeah.
And until you have some success, you know, you're always going to kind of doubt yourself until it actually happens. And I think opening day in 81, my first year, first full season, not only that I'm not playing second base anymore, I'm playing the outfield.
Yeah, right.
I lead off the game. We're in Pittsburgh. My first at-bat, battle, get a walk. And then I take off on the first pitch. The ball gets away, hits me, gets away, trickles off into the outfield, and I score on that play.
And everyone's like, whoa.
And I'm thinking, you know, wow. You know, it's not that easy, but
that was
you
easy.
Know, that was encouraging for
right,
me because,
right.
you know, I had never really seen that. And to do it in my first full season, first game, kind of got the ball rolling. I think if I would have struck out there and maybe not even got any hits in that game, who knows what would have happened, because the psyche of players is it's confidence.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the psyche. In studio with me, Tim Raines. He's the author of Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. Of course, the Hall of Fame baseball player for the Expos, the White Sox, the Yankees, other stops in between. But let's take a quick break so we can stay on time tonight, and we'll continue our conversation at the big table with Tim Raines. Stay with me. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in the studio at the big table, Tim Raines, the Major League Baseball Hall of Famer who played some time here in Chicago. We'll talk about that. He's got a new memoir, Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. He mentioned, right before the break, we talked about the psyche. You know, and you mentioned, you know, coming up and starting 1-for-20, only batting 50. A lot of what you do, and I think about stealing bases, is about confidence and about the idea of just willing yourself to win by inches.
Mm-hmm.
How important is it when you talk about psyche and confidence and issues of being mentally aware to the game of baseball?
I think it plays a big role. And, you know, as players, you know we can play the game, but until we actually go out and do it, there's an unsureness about that. At the major league level, it's a different story. The minor league level, sure, you know, you can probably be the best minor league player in baseball, but maybe you can't make it at the major mm-hmm. league level. And I think you have to get over that hump. You know, I'm not in the minors anymore. I'm playing against the best players in the world, and I have to compete at that level. And you know, if you don't be consistent doing it, you won't be there long. And that's the one good thing, that you know if you don't play well, you're going to be out of town.
That's a great point. I mean, for you, I mean, you're a model of consistency. I mean, you could expect an over 300 batting average, a certain number of stolen bases. You were always competitive. How important is that? I mean, when you talk about, to think about some of the career stats you put up and to think about some years in Montreal where you're hitting 330, 335, like it was just, that's just normal. That's what you do. And obviously those numbers led you to the Hall of Fame. You know, as a player, as someone who is, okay, we know you're going to hit 330. We know you're going to steal 50, 60, 70, 80 bases. Do you buy into that? Do you feel like the confidence is there that you're like, I know I'm going to hit 330. I know I'm going to steal this base. I know I'm the kind of player that can do this.
Well, you know, you have to have that type of confidence within yourself. I mean, in order to be able to do it anyway, you have to have that talent. You know, once you realize you have it, you have to kind of use it to the fullest. And if you don't, then like again, I said, you know, you never know how long you're going to be there. But I was always that guy that, regardless of how well I play one year, the next year I want to be better. You know, you always want to strive. You know, I try not to set certain goals. I just try to set a goal is just to have the best year that I can have.
Yeah.
Not be injured, try to play as many games as I can. And if that happens, there's no telling what I can do. And I enjoy playing and thinking that way, because if you think that way, then you don't set yourself up for certain goals, and then once you achieve them, then you want to just kind of chill out for the rest
of
the
year.
Yeah,
well, you talk about a little bit in the book about the age of stats and you know, guys that you were compared to and continued throughout your career, guys like Ricky Henderson come to mind. You know, even in the 90s, when you played in the 90s, it became almost like the only stat that mattered was how many times you hit the ball out of the ballpark. You know, for you, not thinking about stats and really hammering home that wasn't true, is that real? I mean, as a player, you were not thinking about how many stolen bases you had, how many doubles, how many triples?
Not at all. I mean, and the people might say I'm lying, but I'm not. You know, I've never felt like if there was a target number, you know, say, just say, you know, Ricky Henderson stole 130 bases. I'm not going to put myself in a position to say I want to steal more bases than Ricky Henderson stole this year and put myself in a position to be so concerned about that, mm-hmm. that I don't be concerned about the other part of the game. You know, I've always felt I never want to be that guy to say Tim Raines, he's a guy that stole a lot of bases. I wanted people to recognize me as a guy that played the game in every facet, you know, hitting, driving runs in, you know, stealing bases, yeah, but a hitter that, you know, when the game is on the line, you want him at the plate instead of, I don't know, and this guy's just a singles hitter.
Right,
you know, and I
wasn't a singles hitter.
I mean, I hit home runs. I wasn't a home run hitter, but, I mean, I averaged, you know, 10 to 12 home runs a year. But that wasn't what I was trying to do. If I hit home runs, that was cool. But I wanted people to recognize me as an overall player that did it all, you know, a 5-tool player, not just a guy that could run.
And I think that is that's why you're in the Hall of Fame. I mean, you're the original kind of player like that. I'm really interested in stealing bases, because that is when you think about, you get into the game of baseball, and it's funny because I don't think too many in this day and age, when you think of 2017, of guys who are stealing 70, 80, 90 bases. There's a couple guys, a guy down in Florida, mm-hmm. D. Gordon steals bases. There's others who had done it. Then Marlin seemed to be the manufacturer guys who steal bases. But when I think of that concept, just the idea, the art of stealing a base. I think about the guy leading off. I think about the pitcher throwing over there, leaning, all that kind of mental stuff, the game, the strategy that's in it. Take us through that. I mean, were you a kind of player that was like, I'm going to lead off three steps and I'm going to run? Or were there intricacies? Were you watching for little tells in the pitcher? How much of it was chess to Tim Raines?
It was more chess. I mean, I knew every move pitcher would make. You know, I knew how quick they were to the plate. I knew what type of moves they had. I mean, I know if he set his feet one way, he's going to go one way. I mean, I really focused and studied pitchers. I mean, in order for me to be successful, I mean, yes, I could run. I mean, it doesn't matter how fast you can run, but, I mean, you cannot run a baseball. And that's the part of the game that I think people don't understand.
Yeah.
And most time when we're stealing bases, it's not so much off of the catcher. Usually it's off the pitcher. You know, if you gave a catcher time, they can throw anybody out. But if you got great jumps, if you were on your way to second before the guy even started going to the plate, it makes it so much harder for the catcher to, you know, one, they're going to try to rush to try to throw you out, and then they've got to make perfect throws, because if you're there in time, if that ball throws off an inch or two, you're going to be safe.
It's amazing to me, too, because, and I know you want to be typecasted this way, but if Tim Raines gets on first base, Tim Raines is going to steal second. And as a fan, as everyone in the building and watching on TV is like, Tim Raines is going to try to steal second. The pitcher knows that. Everybody knows that. There's no element of surprise.
Right.
And yet you still do it. And yet you still make it. I mean, the amount of the percentage of stolen bases made versus caught is, I mean, that's why you're in the Hall of Fame, the idea that you rarely recall. So right. The idea, how do you deal with the fact that the element of surprise is gone?
Well, that was the cool part about it, you know, knowing that everybody in the world, not just, you know, in that game or on that field or watching television, everybody knows I'm going. And to be able to know that and then be successful doing it makes you feel a little different, a little more different from other people. And it makes you a little bit special, but not to the point to where you're cocky or mm-hmm. you feel like you're the best player in baseball or anything like that. But that's a skill that I feel like I could utilize in the game of baseball. That kind of gave me a feeling of my football background.
Right.
You know,
right.
You know, when you're playing football, everyone's trying to stop you from getting the first down or from getting the touchdown. And everybody know you're going to get the ball. But if you get it, and they know you're going to get it, but you still get around and you get a touchdown or a first down. That's the kind of sport.
There's yeah. something about the idea
the
that, yeah.
that, you know, that great players and great athletes want to have. And if you don't have that, then you shouldn't be playing at the professional level.
Right.
But that's just a feeling that you have. And not so much. I mean, some guys are cocky about it. But, I mean, I always just wanted to compete and compete at the highest level. And, you know, me against you, today, who's going to be the best? And it's not always right. going to be – I'm not always going to be the best, and I understood that. But I never, like, wavered from, okay, you got me today, tomorrow I'm going to get you, or I'm going to get you later on today. So that's the kind of way I played the game.
Baseball Hall of Famer Tim Raines in studio tonight. His memoir, Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane, is out now. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on the news. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation with Tim Raines at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. My guest at the Big Table tonight, Tim Raines, the Hall of Fame, I would say Hall of Fame Expo, because you went in as an Expo, but we also know you as a Chicago White Sox. You played on the team, a team that is dear to White Sox hearts, the early 90s teams that went to the playoffs and probably would have went again during the strike-shortened season. You also coached for Ozzie Guillen, coached first base on the teams that went and won the World Series. And you talked about, I mean, it's amazing to me that there are two strike-shortened seasons in baseball, and you were on two teams that were affected by it. And how do you view that? Because for the Expos in 81 or 82, they were 81. You guys ended up going to the playoffs, right. So it worked out. Right. But in 94, in a position where you guys were in first place and didn't get a chance to finish it out. Do you think about that, the idea that two of your most successful seasons, playoff, and besides the stuff you did with the Yankees, were shortened by a strike?
Well, the one that comes to mind the most is the 94. You know, White Sox team, because, you know, the reason why I went, you know, ended up being traded and won to go to Chicago was for that reason. I had a young up-and-coming team, some great young players, Thomas, Ventura, great staff with Fernandez and Hernandez and, you know, Blackjack. I mean, we had a staff. I mean, we had some great players as well, so... That one kind of comes to mind more than the 81 season because
we still got to go to the playoffs.
Personally, in the 81 season, I felt like I was robbed personally. But the 94 season, I felt like the team was robbed because, you know, we had some great players. We had proven that we were on our way on a rise, mm-hmm. on our way to hopefully becoming a world champion team, and you know that was taken away. The other cool thing about it was. The 94 Expos was the best team in the National League.
Right. How great would that have been?
So, you know, just thinking about that, you know, the chances of me going to the World Series with the White Sox, which is the reason why I wanted to go, and then the Expos, you know, going to the World Series.
Amazing,
and the reason why I left Montreal because they weren't going in that direction. I don't know what happened when I left, but that's the one year out of my whole career that I feel like I wish I could get a mulligan.
You talked about it in the book, and you talked about the difference of the cities that you played in. I mean, you talked about Montreal, and even at the beginning, they were really amped about baseball. But as time went on, and as we know the fabled story of Montreal moving to Washington, but the idea that the fan base kind of left the team up in Montreal. But in Chicago, you talked about the idea of it wasn't a North Side or South Side. It wasn't Cubs or White Sox. It was this love of baseball that the city provided.
And that's true. And, you know, when you look at the different cities in professional sports, you look at, you know, the big cities like New York, and you kind of put Chicago kind of in between, not as big media-wise as New York, but kind of in the middle, but big enough where you're going to be recognized. It might not always be the top story, but and during that time, too, the Bulls was kicking butt all the time. So, yeah. I mean, there was,
well, I mean, Michael Jordan retired while you guys were in. That's a famous story. You guys were in the playoffs and he retired.
So Chicago was, and the football team was doing well as well. So, and, you know, and we in 91, you know, we had start proving that we were a good team as well. So The city was really popping during those times. And it was a joy to play here. It was a joy to play in front of the fans. We had just got a new stadium. I didn't even play in the old stadium. I think I played one game. And that was an all-star game in the old stadium. So it was like a whole new way of being a White Sox.
You know, it's fun. It's fun to reading the book, and I didn't know this as a fan, but there, you know, you clean up the story of Rock Raines. You know, because When you came to Chicago, you were Rock Raines, and we're like, I thought we traded for Tim Raines. This is the All Star Montreal Expo. Who's Rock Raines? Is this his brother? But and you talked about that you made almost a name change when you came to Chicago, but it didn't stick.
No, what happened was, you know, when I first got over here, it's my first time in the American League, and I had a tough time against American League pitchers. You know, they pitched me totally different than the way I was for 11 years in the National League. Guys were throwing me fastballs, and I was hitting fastballs. I come over here, I couldn't get any fastballs. I mean, I was like, wow, they definitely pitched me a lot different over here, and it took me half the season to kind of make the adjustment. Actually, it started out Tim Raines, but I was having such a terrible time at the plate, man. I said, look, something is going to have to change. So I went to the PA announcer, and I talked to the front office and said, look, man, we're going to have to do something here. If anything, just instead of announcing me Tim Raines, announce me Rock Raines. And for at least 3 or 4 months, or maybe towards the end of that season, they started announcing, now I'm batting Rock Raines.
And that was your nickname from college or
from high school. My first year in pro ball.
Yeah, pro ball.
And then people start asking, who's Rock Raines? I'm like, that's me, you know. But like, is that your real name? So it wasn't. I didn't change it from my real name. I just felt like, okay, I just need a little change here to kind of get me going. Once it gets me going, then we can go back.
What was was it Torberg who said, Rock Raines has been waived, and we just called up Tim Raines when you were in a slump? That was the thing. When you're in a slump like that, when you're realizing, you know, you had – what, 8, 9, at this point, 10 years, yeah. 11 years in the league, yeah. And you come into a new environment and it's not going the way that you're used to as an all-star, as a player who can just turn it on. Mm-hmm. Paul, what does it mentally do to you? I mean, we hear baseball is a game of slumps, ups and downs, that kind of stuff, but as a guy who's only had success, only had consistency, on his way to a Hall of Fame career, what does it do when you're not the Tim Raines that you know?
Well, you don't know. You don't know, especially when you're in a new city, new league. You're playing against new players, so it's like starting all over again. And I didn't realize it was going to be that difficult. And until you actually do it, you don't think that is ever going to happen, you know, especially when, you know, your career is just going year after year, you're having good year after good year, and it's successful. That's all you think about. Okay, what am I going to do next year? I'm going to have another good year. But see, well, we can kind of get a little better from one part of the game or another. But when you go to a new place, new town, new ballpark, you know, new teammates, you hope to continue to do the same thing they were doing with the other organization, but you're not sure. And it's a big difference. It was a big difference between the National League and the American League when it came to the style of play.
Yeah, right.
You got the DH, a lot more breaking balls, regardless of when they threw breaking balls. I mean, 3-0, I got curveballs. 3-1, I got breaking ball, some kind of breaking ball. And normally
they didn't even care
about walking me in the American League. So, I mean, partly the reason, they're not going to walk me, so they're going to throw me fastball. So I'm getting changeups, I'm getting breaking balls. So I'm like, eventually these guys are going to throw me a fastball. Right. And it never happened, and that was the difference. I just didn't foresee that. You know, that wasn't going
to
change.
Well, you came back to your consistent ways with the White Sox, and you had a great years in 93, 94, 95. And you had the chance to move on and win a World Series with the Yankees. We'll skip that. We don't care about the Yankees. The interesting thing is how your career ended. And it was an ailment. It was lupus that came on, and you had to treat it like cancer, as chemotherapy, all of the things that you counted on, your body, your ability, everything that had made you who you were was taken away from you. by this disease. What was that like? What was it like for you to be in that situation where you know you still had, you still wanted to play? I know Tim Raines still wanted to play, right, and you couldn't.
Well, first of all, I didn't really know what lupus was when I was diagnosed, and then I had to, you know, had to research it and find out, you know, what I had got myself into. I wasn't really worried about baseball at the time. I was worried about if I'm going to live.
Life, right?
I mean, you know, how much time do I have? I mean, what do I, you know, can I get over this? Is this something that's going to be for the rest of my life? You know, can it be cured? And I found out all those answers, and it took me about 8 months to 10 months to finally starting to feel better. And, you know, I had to make a decision. I mean, I could have walked away from the game. I felt like I had a great career. But there was something I wanted to do before my career was over. And the reason why I came back, I had an opportunity to, you know, get a chance to play in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was ready. I went in and I worked out for the Olympic team. And I did well. I played in an independent league and did what I had to do. But It didn't work out. So if it hadn't been for that, I probably would have walked away from baseball.
Yeah.
And when I was turned down, probably the first time in my career that I was turned down for making a team, it inspired me. It inspired me to prove to baseball and to the Olympic team or the Olympic committee that I can make a major league team and I can't make an Olympic team. And that was all like minor league players. And you know, I can't make a major, but I can make a major league team. So
right.
I got ready. I did what I had to do. I went back to the Expos. They gave me an opportunity, which was, love them for just giving me a chance. And that's all I wanted.
Right.
I mean, if I wasn't good enough, then send me home. And that would have been cool with me because, you know, I did what I could
right,
do.
Right, right.
But I went there. I made the team. I was opening day starter for a Montreal team.
I remember that. That was
a young team. But, you know, after that, it was all, that's all I wanted. I wanted to prove that I could still play. And I had a good season. I think I batted over 300 that
year. Of course you did. Tim Raines, right?
Yeah. It ended up getting a chance to play with my son at the end of that season.
Yeah, that's great. There's great stories in the book. And, you know, go check it out. Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. It's a memoir of Tim Raines. The last thing you talk about is being inducted into the Hall of Fame, which just happened in January. And, you know, you get to be alongside Andre Dawson as an Expo, and you get a chance to be among the best that have ever played the game. What does it mean to you to have, after the whole season career you had, starting as an unbelievable rookie, having the drug problem that was highly public, to going through the seasons, to winning a World Series, to having lupus and then turning it around? What's it mean to you to be a Hall of Famer?
Oh, it means everything. I mean, from where I started, young kid from a small town, being drafted to play with a team I didn't really even know about when I was drafted. And it took me a while to believe that baseball was going to be the sport that I ended up playing. I mean, I felt like I was going to give myself 2 years, two full seasons, and see what happens. If I would have failed, then I would have, like, went to college and played football. That was my second choice.
Your fallback, right?
Right. So I'm thinking, you know, baseball is cool, but I don't know if I can play baseball. But I got a backup plan.
As a Hall of Famer says.
Right,
usually,
but thank
right.
God it worked out the way it did. You know, I never really, you know, when I first started and I made the major leagues, Hall of Fame was the last thing from my mind. You know, it was taking one day at a time and trying to be a major leaguer for as long as I could be a major leaguer. And even when it was over for me, I didn't think about the Hall of Fame. I know I had a great career. I think playing in Montreal, I didn't get the notoriety that a lot of other players got throughout their careers around the same time. But I knew I had a great career. So I knew it was going to take some doing for, you know, hopefully I had enough reporters that knew enough about me that would get me in. But if it didn't, you know, it wasn't the end of the world if I didn't get in.
Yeah.
So by it being 10 years, you know, people thought I was upset for all those 10 years. I wasn't upset. I mean, I just felt like if it was meant to be, it's meant to be. And now I don't have to answer that question anymore.
It's meant to be. Tim Raines, Tim Rock Raines in studio, the memoir Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. Mr. Raines, a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for being my guest and talking about your career.
Thanks for having me, man.